Chair Workforce Innovation Board. It's great to see so many board members here. I appreciate you all being here with us today, as I know everyone's schedules are very busy. We have a full agenda and lots of information to cover. Workforce is a critical issue facing New Hampshire, and the board plays a critical role in this area. So let's get started. We'd like to take a moment to see if anyone from the public would like to provide any public comment. If so, please state your name prior to speaking. Alright, we start our agenda here today with this one, with some informational items. These are reports and updates provided to the board. These do not require a vote, however, if board members would like to make motions, I would ask you to please wait until the next section on our agenda. Please remember, before speaking, please state your name for recording. Joe, could you please guide for these items?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the record, Joe Dorian. We're going to welcome Associate Commissioner Christine Santinello and Deputy Commissioner Richard Labors. For some informational materials, and then we're going to welcome Brian Rockwell from New Hampshire Employment Security as well after we have some presentations to the board.
I guess I got my steps in walking all the way down here. So I'm Chris Santinello, and I'm here to talk about two things actually. First is the Council on Housing Stability and our strategic plan for that definite. Commissioner Kapatis is on that, Rich Labors participates, there's someone from DOE. So we have a lot of community participation, and it definitely impacts workforce housing. So I'm going to try to do this here. Okay, so the Council on Housing Stability was created in November. The Friday before Thanksgiving, thank you, Jonathan Melanson, by Governor Sununu, for the purpose of creating and implementing a plan to create housing stability for all citizens. And this actually replaced, there used to be an interagency coordinating council on homelessness. But homelessness is the problem, not the solution, right? And so we really wanted to be solution-focused when it came to thinking about housing and housing instability. And so there's 41 members of the council, and I think what's important to note with the council is it's co-led by the Department of Health and Human Services, by Commissioner Caswell at the Department for Business and Economic Affairs, and the Community Development Finance Authority, because we recognize that housing crosses all citizens in New Hampshire, workforce, homelessness, families, and so we really wanted to create housing stability across the board. And we have four working groups to really help us with developing our strategic plan. And I see Brian back there, and he was very involved, and we were actually on a call yesterday. And we focused on housing instability and homelessness and data, as well as planning, regulation, and regional coordination. Despite our really low unemployment numbers here in New Hampshire and our really strong economy, we have a lack of affordable housing. And I'm sure many of you in the workforce are like, how do we bring in new workers when we have housing concerns, as well as high cost of housing. And so construction has not moved forward since the Great Recession of 2008. But yet demand has continued to increase. Our median rental costs have been increasing, and you can see the median rent across all of the counties here in New Hampshire. And we require the 15th highest wage in the nation to afford our housing. And that comes out to be about $23 an hour to maintain a two-bedroom home. And I think about a lot of the individuals and families we bring into New Hampshire, you want people to buy a home, become part of their community, and stay invested in their community. and New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority estimates that about 20,000 more units are needed in order to fill our current housing gap, which does not get to the future. So what we were charged with was developing a plan for housing stability for 3 years for the state, which I think you have in your packet. Okay. And as well as looking at creating a plan for homelessness. So we know that housing ends homelessness and creates stability, so that's our vision. We also know that greater access to affordable housing is going to assist New Hampshire's businesses and strengthen our economy. We know that individuals and families experiencing homelessness and housing instability often have other conditions impacting their circumstances. I think back to, in my own life, how many of you all have moved in the last 10 years? Anybody? And how stressful was that for them? And was it a positive move? So think about a lot of families who are experiencing homelessness, the constant moving and having it not be a, and having it be stressful, and think about their conditions on work, right? How can you focus at work if you have chaos at home? How can you focus in school? So we really want to create stability. Housing stability is one of our social determinants of health, and it's essential for all adults and children and families to thrive. And investing in housing is a better solution for individuals, families, and communities because it creates improved health, social, educational, and economic outcomes, right? We know there's lots of businesses across the state that need workers, and yet paired with that is they need affordable housing. And needed services and support should be delivered in each community based on the strengths of each community. So we created a plan to ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, and one time. And in doing that, we recognize that the low supply and high demand makes it really hard for employers to hire and retain workers. And housing demand has the greatest pressure at the lower end of the market, which creates unstable housing. And so we really need to figure out how to make that stable. We recognized prior to the pandemic there was an increase in people experiencing homelessness at 21%. And what's really fascinating, what we learned during the pandemic, and if we were working with one of the shelters in the Seacoast area, is the high number of people in their shelter who actually had a job, but they just couldn't find or afford housing. And when we were assisting them with some decompression during the pandemic, she actually was able to move some of those individuals into hotels temporarily so they could continue to work. So it's not people that are not trying to work, not trying to get ahead. It's just the resources aren't always there. And our unduplicated homeless management system indicates that there's over 4,000 people, including children and families, who receive some form of services. So our North Star is really ensuring that homelessness is rare, brief, and one time. So we have some really big picture goals. One of those is to end veterans homelessness by 2022. Reduce first-time homelessness by 30%. What we found in some of our data is the number of people experiencing homelessness, 70% of them, it's one time. It's their first time. And increase the number of housing units by 13,000. 500 by 2024. Again, we need housing to end homelessness. So, what are some things that we're doing to make it happen? We're improving our crisis response, service infrastructure, and policies that support individuals and families to maintain housing in their communities. We're also looking at what are the regulatory barriers. There's a lot of barriers in each community. That impact affordable housing. we really need to look at the increased production of affordable housing. And we also need to think about how do we handle some private market housing production and really think about existing structures for rental housing. What about some of the commercial space that isn't needed now? How can we turn that into housing? What about malls that aren't being used? How do you turn that into housing? We're working on a productive legislative strategy, hopefully, that will increase housing production. And really looking at a governance structure that connects state government with local communities. Because what we found is, in New Hampshire, where we have an immense amount of local control, which we all respect and we want to see happen, how do we make sure we get some statewide strategic initiatives and some best practices across the board? So we have some one-year strategies because we have a three-year action plan, strategic plan. We have one-year action plan so we can really move forward with a number of our goals. So what we're really trying to look at is how can we use some of the American Rescue Plan dollars to really help us with those one-time investments? How can we take those dollars that are one-time to build our infrastructure? We're really working on launching a statewide campaign to recruit private landlords and really provide some financial incentives for them to work with their local shelters, to take house, the housing choice vouchers, providing them some of the resources they need to match up with some of the requirements. Increase our homelessness prevention funding to really talk about shelter diversion. How do we work to not have people come into shelters? How do we work with our outreach teams as well as our local and municipal welfare agencies so that we're all working in sync to increase housing stability? Provide financial support to local communities to make regulatory changes that promote affordable housing development, and some communities are already doing this. And really looking at coordinated funding applications that combine capital, operating, and supportive services to reduce the production. I think what we find in a lot is working with communities and social service agencies and developers is by blending and braiding the different funding streams, which is super hard, right? But that really helps us get to the outcomes we want to get to, and so providing that. And then use community input for repurposing a vacant commercial space. I live in the Lakes region, and so every time I drive by a certain vacant space, I think, oh my gosh, this would be phenomenal for housing. And I am trying to get to those developers, right? So some things we're looking at for collaboration is really some of our cross-systems data to really make sure that communities have the data they need. What's being invested? What are some resources? How do we make this all work? How do we maximize Medicaid dollars? Lots of times we have developers who are willing to house some people who may be vulnerable, but what are the supports that person needs to maintain housing? Our goal is to really keep people housed. Increase leadership opportunities for people with lived experience. It's fascinating having people who have been homeless sitting at the table. Really develop real-time data on housing needs. And really, how do we have, New Hampshire has three different areas for housing services across the state, and how do we better match them with the regional planning commissions, county government, and all of the services people need to move this agenda forward. So we're really looking at funds from the American Rescue Plan to really help us with some of these one-time costs. We estimate about $45 million could really help us with the necessary support of the one-time investment, and so we're continuing to work on that. So that, I believe you have our strategic plan. There's lots of information on our website. I know I gave you a lot of information in a really short period of time, but I don't know if anybody has any questions or thoughts.
Tim Frank.
Okay.
And in terms of What was the point about providing funding for local communities and things to deal with the regulatory issues?
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about how those funds are used and what that would look like?
So one of the things where we have to actually get the funds from the American Rescue Fund, but we're actually working really closely with New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, and we actually have some staffing support to help communities really figure out, okay, what are some of the regular, what are some barriers that need to change? How can we work together? How can we provide some incentives? So a lot of it would be done through incentives and researching that way. So if you have a community, let us know.
So this would be funds for local municipalities?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you plan to fund the $13,500 by 2024?
Because we worked actually with the Office of Strategic Initiatives. Is that, I'm looking at Jill, because now it's in your shop, right?
Yeah, it's now the Office of Planning.
Yeah, so
and
Brian helped too. We actually looked at what our what's some of the data coming into the state, and then we actually increased it a little bit. So it's all with done with the planning, the Office of Planning and Strategic Initiatives.
So where are we getting money coming from?
We're hoping to use some of the American Rescue Fund dollars. Yes, that's what we're hoping to do. Just because a lot of that money is one-time investment,
right.
And we know that there's a huge need for people to have housing.
Do you have an idea of what the, how much you need to raise to supply $13,500?
I don't have that off the top of my head, but I can get that for you.
It's about $2.7 billion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just thinking we should have a strategy to get that.
Yeah, point. Yep. We're working on different strategies.
Jim Broom,
yep.
My question, if you had any examples of recent success where this has been implemented in communities prior to this?
Yeah, so in the Portsmouth community, they, through Seacoast United Way, they had a Housing for All, which really combined some supportive services and landlord outreach. So we're looking to replicate some of those statewide with some funding that we're hoping to get to really to work with landlords on to how do we provide those supportive services. So that worked really well. And then we did a lot of work throughout the pandemic by increasing outreach and really combining all of the social service programs and working in one team. And we did a lot of that work in Manchester, and that was really successful. So we're looking to replicate a lot of those pieces.
And I haven't read the plan, but where does transportation fit into the overall plan? And has there been any outreach to the businesses who are desperate for the workers
right.
to work in conjunction, whether it's transportation, whether it's housing assistance, or
yeah. So that's really why we had, throughout the whole development of the strategic plan, that's why we really looked at not having it be just Health and Human Services, right? Because we're just one piece of it. So that's why we really had Business and Economic Affairs at the table. We had over 80 people volunteer on different work groups. And so one of the pieces that we're continuing to work on is some regional work and regional collaborations and really working with the local planning commissions because they're doing housing assessments through part of their region. So really coordinating all of the work, and that's where we really are thinking about what are some innovative strategies and working with local communities because they have some of those resources. They may have a business, and transportation is always a concern. And so we have Department of Transportation at the table and really be thinking about, okay, when we think about, okay, how do we use the space, what are all these other pieces that have to be considered? Because that's a real barrier for people is transportation. Sorry, there and there.
Hey, Kathy, when you locate a community that really needs a lot of housing, you also examine zoning to find out if there are things you can recommend so that developers are more encouraged
yeah.
to build, because I see it in our upper valley. The zoning holds a lot of these developers back.
So that's not me, because I'd be like, just do it. No, just kidding. Well, I'm being recorded. No, and so that's why through some of our funding we have, New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority will be taking the lead in that and actually hiring somebody to work with the local communities on some of the zoning regulations for all of those pieces, because that's what we're really finding a lot of. So we're looking at all of those strategies, because we really realize it isn't something that just happened overnight, right? It's taken time, and so what do we need to do to kind of flip it and turn it the other way?
Dwight Davis, Chris. You mentioned commercial properties. We're working on using some commercial properties for homes. What communities have you ever seen or studied? Mm-hmm. Anywhere in the country that has been successful doing this?
So there has been some. There's some work being done actually in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And then there's other studies in other places, which I can get for you. That's kind of not my part of this whole piece, but Katie from CDFA has that information, and I can get some of that for you.
The reason I ask that question is because I've seen so many malls shutting down.
Yep.
And you have these huge properties and... Mm-hmm. I would think that there should be some communities that are doing that already. Right.
That's what we're looking at. Then. We don't have to recreate the wheel.
One more
question.
More.
Okay. Yep.
Charlie Lovett. What's the strategy for communicating to communities the tools that are out there already for development? Because in my experience, maybe the neighborhood. 79E was a development tool that was approved by the legislature, I believe, in the early 2000s. But the governing body had to adopt it in that community. Well, for Claremont, we adopted it, I think it was 10, 11 years after it was available. And I think the primary reason for that is I don't know if it was well known to the governing body that it was an option. I can tell you every housing development we've had since we adopted 1798 has been due to the availability of that tool.
Mm-hmm. So we're working... We actually were able to get some staffing positions through the Governor's Office of Economic Recovery and Gopher. I always mess up my R's, but to really help with some of that outreach, and outreach is a big piece, and we actually have a staff position at New Hampshire Housing Finance to work with local communities and provide a lot of that information. So that's really some of our tools that we're trying to use to get some of the information out and provide that consultation. Yeah, Senator Kahn.
Hi, Chris. Jay Kahn.
Yeah.
Thank you. The chairman just used a figure, and I have been trying to understand what is the investment and what is, with the state dollars, what is the benefit? So, Chairman, if I can just check this figure, you're anticipating about $200,000 cost per bed? Rough estimate.
Yeah.
Higher than I thought, definitely over $100,000, but whatever. If that's the total investment, and the $45 million is a pretty small discount on that, and so trying to understand then the benefit to a income challenged household to be able to afford it and turn the housing into something affordable. The $45 million supposedly would be used to reduce capital, and that doesn't generate a great discount. So I guess I'm wondering what do we anticipate is the rent? I mean, is the benefit is the 20% market discount? What are we buying with an investment in affordable
housing? The $45 million is just a piece to work on a number of the strategies. And increasing the housing units is one piece, but there's a whole slew of different resources that have to be brought to the table. Private, developers, local community business, right? Because we can't bring workers into the state if we don't have affordable housing. And so really looking at it, and that's with some of our data, community by community, to determine what is the need in those communities and how do we really make those the housing affordable and accessible for our workforce so people stay here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, but we're not giving them the house.
Yeah, exactly.
So support some of that, right?
Yeah.
And you probably get real long-term organizations, right? And probably really low. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's not possible, but it's just a real number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3 years away. So,
right.
It's 3 years away, so.
Yeah. You know, got a lot of work to do. Yeah. So do you want me to do the next one or not? What, I don't know what your agenda is like. I do have a hard stop. Okay, I think.
We have Rich and then Brian as well.
Well, Chris and I were going to
We can do that another time.
It's an easy commute for me today.
Okay.
All right.
We can do that quick.
Yep.
So Rich, this is your computer. I don't know what.
Don't break.
So. Go ahead.
I can talk high level, then you can go into the different strategies.
Yeah. I figured while we had you guys here.
I'll see if it's
okay.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, I can't put it on. Put it on.
Okay, so I'll do a quick high level, and then Chris can talk about some of the specific solutions. So I'm glad that, first, Rich Labors, I work for Commissioner Fabs here at Department of Security. I was glad that he was having everyone here so we could finally show Mike Summers that we're not hiding 30,000 people from the workforce here in the unemployment agency.
We're
going on a tour later on, so we're going to be able to prove that. So housing barriers, which Chris spent some time talking about, the work of the Housing Stability Group, is one of our barriers that we deal with, right? And we know that in addition to housing, we also have other barriers that prevent people from getting into the workforce, and that's what we do with our WIOA programs, with Employment Security and VGA and Southern New Hampshire Services. And we're trying to provide people that need assistance with education, with training, transportation through our programs, helping them get into the workforce, right? And with our partners at BEST, with the community college system, doing all that work. But those barriers don't address all of the issues, right? We have other issues that we refer to as benefit cliff issues that prevent a large number of people from ever getting into our workforce. And by benefit cliffs, we're talking about issues with people that don't take on additional hours or don't take on that new job because of a concern, or not only just a perceived concern, but other experiences that they've seen with friends and family, that the additional hours of that new job actually result in a net loss of resources when you start taking into consideration some of the supports that they were previously receiving, whether that's housing subsidies, SNAP, TANF, Medicaid, that they actually experience a net loss. And it's not just a one-and-done type of cliff that these folks encounter. These are a series of cliffs that families encounter over 5 to 10 years until they're actually going to be in a positive place from having taken on that job. So what we've done through a series of groups that have been tackling this issue since pre-pandemic, we went about bringing in a national group, accounting firm out of Philadelphia that looked at the benefit cliff issues from an economic perspective, right? So we're looking, we know the microeconomic benefits, but from a macro perspective, what are the benefits to the state from expanding our workforce through our existing people who right now are unable to participate because of these benefit cliffs? So we did that analysis, We came up with some great recommendations. Those recommendations have been put through the ringer with teams that Chris has developed and spearheaded by HHS. And now some of those specific recommendations are on a few slides here that Chris can talk about and kind of what the timeline is and what we're trying to do with it.
And I think how New Hampshire approached this with the economic analysis is we really looked at, we didn't look at the whole state, right? So I live in Belknap County. And so what happens in, you know, Barnstead is very different than Meredith. Right, and so we, or even if you think about Tilton, so when we did the economic analysis, we looked at the whole state, we looked at the 10 counties, and then we broke it down into 40 different communities to really look at what is the economic impact for families in those communities. And what happened is when the pandemic hit, instead of saying, we're not going to do this, we expanded our research and really looked at unemployment. Originally, we looked at child care affordability, which is significant as part of the cliff effect, but then we looked at availability and different pieces. And so we did an extensive analysis, and all of that is actually on our website, and you can link to it, and you can see community by community. But what we came up with were different ways to enhance our workforce, because New Hampshire has very low unemployment, and there's individuals who are untapped resources if it was affordable for them to work, because no family wants to take on a job or take on more hours and have their family be worse off, right? That's irresponsible. So what are some things that we can do? So what we looked at is, through our work together, we found there's this list called the High Demand Job List. It's from New Hampshire Employment Security, and there's like 90 jobs. And those are high demand jobs that really have a good return for somebody. And you have the ability to make a lot of money. So what we said was, so for 2 years, we'll allow you to continue receiving your TANF benefit, which really helps families meeting the necessities of a young family while you're working towards this demand job, because that is going to help our workforce. It's also going to help the family. We also are working with an automotive dealership, hopefully, to really think about a savings program, because we know lots of people who are living in poverty will buy a really old used car, and that car needs lots of work. And the minute they can't get to work, then they lose their job, right? So how do we make sure people have really reliable transportation? We know it's not going to be public transportation in all parts of the state. So how can we do a savings program? We're also going to look to change our TANF disregard. Right now, we allow 50% income disregard. We're going to go up to 65%, again, for people to have more money in their pockets so they can afford to go to work, as well as expanding education requirements, looking at the long term, and also a post-TANF support program. What we find is oftentimes it's not the job that people struggle with, it's all the external things happening in their life, whether it's child care, whether it's transportation, other barriers impact somebody's job. We also are going to look to increase our staff gross income limit, because by doing that enables children and families to be eligible for free and reduced lunch. Again, more money in families' pockets, more ability for people to go back to work. Child care is a huge barrier for people, whether it's availability or affordability. And so one of the things we're looking at is, are there some creative ways, and there's some things happening in different parts of the state where business can support child care? Because what we heard loud and clear during the pandemic was business saying, we need child care for our workers to come to work. And it doesn't necessarily mean having child care in the business, because that may not be effective, but we worked with a local business in the Lakes region, and they partnered with a local child care center, so now they're buying slots for some families so that they know as new people come in, they've reserved 5 to 10 slots for children, so they will have child care. The child care centers has that as additional income. So how are some ways that businesses can be creative? I used to run a nonprofit, and for about 5 to 10 years, we actually did the back office for a local child care center because it really helped them bring down their operating expenses, which then in turn goes to wages for their employees. We're also going to look at an increase of eligibility, so more families qualify for child care assistance, which means more families will be able to go to work and afford child care. We're going to raise our state payment rates for non-traditional hours. We hear about this a lot. We don't see a lot of it because it's in isolated situations, but working in communities where they need a lot of second and maybe third shift child care, how do we make that happen? And a lot of that will be done individually. We're going to have more, there's steps we have, which is really confusing, but really to help people maintain more of their money and not pay so much in child care. And then we're really going to look at enrollment-based child care. That's something that we hear a lot because how we pay for the state for people who receive child care assistance, it's not paid. You're only paid when kids attend, so that makes it difficult for child care centers to take children on our scholarship program. And then, this is really exciting. Rich gets really excited about this. As part of our work is we're developing a benefit cliff calculator. So an individual with their case manager, and it's almost live. It's not live yet, but it's going to be live soon, can go in and figure out, if I make this amount of money, what will I lose in benefits? Where's the tipping point for me to increase my wages and not lose my benefits? And it's going to become a planning tool for workers all across the state and case managers to really help families, help individuals figure out what's the breaking point? What can I earn and still maintain my benefits?
And this really goes towards that perception problem, right? If you know someone or a family member that encountered a benefit cliff, just the concern about that, even though you're not in the greatest spot in the world, you're comfortable enough, so you're not going to take the risk, not going to take on those additional hours. This helps combat that perception. So now you can see right in front of your very own eyes with your own data that you've entered through a series of pretty simple questions. Mm-hmm. You can see, okay, where am I going to be if I did go from part-time to full-time or take on that new job? I think it'll have a big impact helping, again, with that perception problem.
And it also will help employers because there was actually a local employer in town who is really vested in a lot of this work, and she talked about, I've increased my starting wage to X. And she's like, oh my gosh, but I never thought about what somebody would lose. And so now an employer could even, model increases to their employees and what it would or would not do. So this will be live, hopefully, the end of this month, early next week. And then also we're also partnering with the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta to expand our CLIF calculator to become policy-level information so we can understand, as a state, what are some of the policy implications, as well as a planner for individuals to know. If you make this amount at this point in your life, what do you need to be making later on to develop financial security? So I think that's kind of it. So more to come on that. Anybody have any questions? And all the information's in your packet. So I know you all have a big agenda. So thank you.
Can I share your emails with the board if I have questions?
Yeah, you can share it, right? Okay.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, could they share that? This is Jay Conn. Could you share the site for the CLIF calculator?
It should. Yeah, it's not live yet.
Right.
But I think put in somewhere. We have a CLIF page at the department, but we can share that as well. Thank you.
mentioned that we've spoken out Brian Rocco from the Hampton Plain Security for all of them.
Bear with me while I get this PowerPoint up. Don't look at my password. Do these folks know what I'm here to talk about? Some do. Yesterday, Commissioner Kapatis asked me if I would be willing to talk about the implications of removal of federal benefits. So, completely not controversial issue. Sure nobody has an opinion on whether there's been an impact. So, I'm going to hopefully shed some light on what I think is happening in New Hampshire, and maybe nationally, but I'm going to focus on what's happening in New Hampshire. It is a very controversial issue. There are almost nobody doesn't have an opinion on it. So everybody either has come to the conclusion that eliminating the federal benefits has had no positive impact on the labor force, or increasing labor force participation, or people, and a lot of business people have said it's one of the reasons why we haven't gotten as many people back in the labor force. I think the evidence is confounded by a number of issues. Okay. So the interesting thing for me about this is it's a wonderful natural experiment, which you don't get very often in economics. There's no artificial treatments here. There's states that ended benefits early. There's states that didn't end benefits early. What's the difference? Classic difference in difference statistical treatment. And it sounds like very straightforward, but it's really not that straightforward. One, because the big influence is a lot of the analysis that I've seen that have come out very quickly have an ideological bent, a political or an ideological bent. If you happen to be a big supporter of ending the benefits, you see the benefits to the labor force the opposite if you didn't support ending the benefits. So I caution people about looking at those kinds of those studies. The bigger issue for me, because now that I'm working for doing work for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is if you know anything about them, numbers get revised regularly, and they get revised employment numbers very substantially at the beginning of every year. This year, the revisions are going to be even greater because there's been a lot of difficulties with the surveying process of businesses and individuals. There's two surveys that are done. Household survey, surveying individuals, that's what we base the unemployment rate on. The payroll survey is a survey of businesses, and that's done about a week later. Both of those surveys have suffered from very low return rates, difficult to get people during the pandemic. The numbers have been a bit erratic. They haven't followed traditional seasonal patterns. The numbers are going to be revised. So we've got studies right now that came out 6 weeks after the ending of federal benefits in some states and have drawn conclusions. There was not a significant impact on the labor force or the opposite. I don't believe we'll really know what happened until after all the revisions are done and after all of the data has been cleaned up, and that's going to take a while. We do have some clues, and I'll talk a little bit about that. The other issue for New Hampshire, when we look at this data, is that we're not uniquely affected, but certainly in the region, we have over 100,000 people that work in other states, in states that did not end federal benefits early. So they had no motivation necessarily to get back into the labor force. They're in technically in our labor force, but they work in Massachusetts, so they're counted in the payroll employment in Massachusetts or were prior to being laid off or stepping out of the labor force. So that's really difficult when such a substantial number of people aren't subject to the same treatment, the same natural experimental treatment. Other big issue, when you look at who ended benefits early, who didn't among states, tended to be
you know, this is the classic interpretation. Red states ended them early, blue states didn't. Well, there's another. Red states, and particularly in the South, tended to have very high levels of COVID during the period immediately following the end of benefits, which obviously impacted the ability of people to go back to work and be employed. The studies that have been done to date, anyway, that I've seen, haven't factored in that yet. Again, making it difficult to really interpret what has actually been the effect. And I have to say, you know, as somebody who's looked at labor market studies forever, it's generally been accepted that unemployment insurance adds a small percentage to the unemployment rate. Not a bad thing. It's the price we pay for a compassionate program to give people income support when they lose their job. The ultimate effect of that is to raise the unemployment rate. As people have a little bit more luxury to look for additional work, or find more appropriate work, so it tends to add to the unemployment rate a quarter to a half a percent. Not a bad thing at all. So to think that adding $600 or $300 and making it a number of other available reasons for being unemployed or stepping out of the labor force with pandemic-related programs, to suggest that that doesn't have some additional impact on the unemployment rate, to me, kind of goes against what is long-standing economic theory. And I don't want to really get in a lot of theory, but just to make that point. And finally, and I'm going to show you a chart related to this, there are demographic factors. It's not a monolithic effect. I think the incentive effects are different for different industries and different age groups. Mike, your workforce, because it's a younger workforce, those additional federal benefits probably, in many cases, provided more income to those individuals within their right and in their eyes, in their best interest, to accept that rather than maybe go back to work. So younger people are more affected. So it's not across the board. I'll talk a little bit about that. So lastly, it'll be a while before the real impact. So hold on. Just to give you an idea of where we are in terms of employment, I only have a total of 7 charges, so it won't be that long. This is where we were employment-wise prior to the pandemic starting in 2018. 670,000 people employed in New Hampshire. This was my forecast of where we would be. This was prior to pandemic. We were going to add about 9/10 of a percent and then 1% the following year, 2020-2021. This is what actually happened with the pandemic, you know, dropping over 100,000 jobs for a relatively short period of time, a big bounce back. But then you see kind of we went back down a little bit. What was going on there? One of the things that was going on there was the addition of federal benefits. So you see that in, you know, if you look at the labor force, you did see some of that. And since that time, we've sort of, you know, it's been a bit of a mixed bag. We've had some ups and downs. And I make this point all the time within this department, sometimes too loudly outside of this department, that I think we're underestimating the employment in the state. I think the Bureau of Labor Statistics is. I think they're undercounting for a number of reasons. So I think that will be revised up. But still, we're not seeing the progress that we would like to see. Anybody here who's a business person understands the labor, the difficulties we've had, despite the fact that we have this, which is job openings, advertised job openings in the state that are higher than they were prior to the pandemic. There are plenty of job openings, and I mean across the board. Every industry has a number of openings. Everybody here who runs the business or is associated with business knows. And I mean, we had labor shortages prior to the pandemic. We had skills gaps. We've got them in spades now. It's exacerbated that situation. Way too complicated of a chart. I'm going to do my best to explain it. A lot of lines going on there. The red line to the upper left is the total number of individuals claiming unemployment benefits on a weekly basis. That's the regular state programs plus the federal programs, the PUA and the PEUC programs. And we only here go back to this April, okay? The blue line below it is just the traditional unemployment insurance program, the state-operated program. In order to qualify, you have to have been laid off, you have to be looking for work, et cetera. Not the federal programs, which allowed people to step out of the or collect unemployment benefits if they were self-employed, if they had issues related to the pandemic, health concerns, child care, a number of reasons qualify for unemployment benefits that they did not qualify them in the regular program. The text up there is some significant policy actions that were taken during the most recent 7 months or so since April of this year. So in April, I think April 24th, the governor announced the return of work search requirements. Okay, we were starting to trend down. That probably prompted, because they had to certify that they were looking for work, probably prompted some people to get back into labor force, accept some work. Later, in May, the work search took effect, May 23rd. At the same time, the governor announced that federal benefits, federal unemployment benefits, the PUA, PUC programs were going to be ending June 19th. And at the same time announced a back-to-work stipend of $1,000 for individuals who work 8 consecutive weeks after a period of unemployment. So that was just significant. Again, if you look, you see pretty consistent decline. Even before the federal benefits ended, we saw a decline. Federal benefits, the last week was June 26th, I think, for actually filing of eligibility, 19th. 26th was the last week that they were paid, probably, right? Okay. That's not my end of the business. I'm just after the federal benefits ended, big drop. And since that time, the blue line, which is our regular unemployment, we're back to pre-pandemic levels. And if you look at initial unemployment claims, most recent week, I think just under 300, under 3,000 in terms of continued unemployment. Those are pre-pandemic levels. I think the year before we had, the year before the pandemic, the lowest we had ever had, I think, was 2,400 in a week. And somewhere under 300 for initial unemployment. So we're back to pre-pandemic levels. The yellow line is not seasonally adjusted employment. So as those claims are going down, employment was going up. It's kind of plateaued a little bit and it's turning down. I think some of that is management error. So 80% decline. So I do think there's been some positive impact from the removal of the federal benefits. But again, we're still affected by over 100,000 individuals who, during this time period, until early in September, were still allowed to collect federal benefits if they're working in Massachusetts, Vermont. So. Oops. This is a really dirty chart, but it's labor force, how the labor force has changed, and this is actual seasonal adjustment. Too much more than you need to know, but the seasonal adjustment process is designed to do one thing. It's designed to smooth out the big ups and downs that happen regularly throughout the year. People come in and out of the labor force. You know, students come in the summer, they leave in the fall because they go back to school. Big hiring, people enter at Christmas time because there's lots of jobs. So you get a big seasonal adjustment is designed to smooth all of that out. Strictly a statistical process. But when you look at this, these are seasonally adjusted numbers. And I highlight Massachusetts. There is no way on earth that a labor force is bouncing around like that unless there's something else going on. What's going on, in my view, is that the models that are used to do this are messed up. The seasonal adjustment models are messed up. Another reason why I think we need to wait until we're not doing model-based estimates, but we're actually doing every quarter we do a census of our employers. We get a solid number of the people that are working in every state. It's 6 months lagged. When those numbers come out, then we have a much better idea of how many people are employed, and that's the bench related to the benchmarking process, it's called. When all that shakes out, we'll see different numbers. And until we have those numbers, we can't really, from my perspective, assess what's happening. We have anecdotal evidence. I think it's been beneficial, but we don't have solid. This is the last chart. When I talk about, I didn't really want to come here to give you opinions, but I have a thesis, or I have a hypothesis. And that is that the impact of the incentive effect of federal benefits greatly differs by age group. There's a couple of things happening on this chart. This shows the difference in labor force participation in the year before the pandemic in the month of August compared to the month of August of this year, so during the pandemic. A couple of groups have had huge declines in their labor force participation. One is older residents. Why would that be? Well, I tried to get this data for New Hampshire, haven't been able to do it, but nationally, filings for Social Security are at record levels as a percentage of people who are eligible. A lot of people step out of the labor force. In New Hampshire, our older population tends to be wealthier than the national average. So when you think about what's happened over the last couple of years with stock market gains, housing values, people's nest eggs have increased substantially, so more people feel more comfortable, I believe, in stepping out of the labor force. And I think that's what you see. Because that 60 to 64 age group, those are people who, normally necessarily wouldn't step out of the labor force. Some would, but not in the numbers that we've seen. And this is a big blow. These are people who, a lot of them are not likely to come back into the labor force. And for me personally, when I do forecasts of labor force and employment, it's counting on people working longer. Fewer of the jobs that we have require physical, abilities. So it was trending up longer. People were working longer. Not necessarily because they had to, although some did, but largely because they were able to. Work didn't demand a lot of physical work. So those are folks that it's going to be hard to get back. Other end is people in the 20 to 24 in particular. Think about the characteristics of those individuals. One, they don't have a lot of responsibilities for the most part. Two, they're employed heavily in industries that, like retail, hospitality industries, where they dominate. Industries that when you're getting a federal benefit of $600 or $300, you've got stimulus payments of $1,200 and $600. You got the luxury of moving home for a while. And certainly that's not everybody. But for a 20 to 24-year-old, $600, $300, plus whatever you're getting in state unemployment benefits probably got you more. And I did this analysis very early in the pandemic with the $600. Two-thirds of the individuals were making more in unemployment than they were in the state were making more than they made employed. And it was largely because of the industries that people were laid off in heavily. Tended to be personal care, retail, a lot of hospitality jobs. People in close contact, those businesses got shut down. So they had the luxury of maybe waiting or looking for, the right opportunity to go back into labor. Those are people who I think will come back. You can't be 20 and 24 years old and stay out of the labor force. Or 25 to 29, still a demographic group that by and large isn't, married with families. Certainly there are some. I do not believe that the federal benefits had a substantial impact on, people in the middle of their, their careers, their earning lives. If you're married and got kids, you're not stepping out of the labor force because of the Fed benefits. But there are groups, and particularly that young group, which populates, again, industries that are having the hardest time getting people back into work. And I think that's what's happening. So, took longer than I had hoped for, but I'll take questions. Yes?
We've read about record savings, right?
Yes.
During this, and has there been any correlation between the decrease in the level of savings and the return to work? Is that, have we started to see savings start to be depleted? Because if you talk about that 20 to 29-year-old bracket, to your point, low, what do you say, liabilities, ability to live at home, that kind of thing, right? Eventually, they'll run out of money in theory, right? As they buy down that savings or spend down that savings. Is there any correlation?
The savings rate data that I have doesn't have it broken down by age.
But it's good that
it hasn't yet, really.
It hasn't started to drop.
No, it really hasn't. Savings rates are still at record levels, which is, you know, in some ways a really good thing. You know, a lot of concern about the economy. People are,
but they tied that to the incentive program, right?
Right. It did, but it was, the incentive program had some impact. I mean, look, we had a quarter during the pandemic, high unemployment rates, where personal income grew at a record rate. Why was that? Because of what? Transfer payments. What's transfer payments? Well, it's things like Social Security, but it's also unemployment benefits, and it's all the stimulus payments. So early this year, the first quarter of this year, we had record high personal income growth quarter over quarter. And despite how many people were unemployed, and it was because of transfer payments. There was more done to keep income levels up, keep income support going during this pandemic, this recession, than has ever been done. And, you know, people still have, I mean, one, they couldn't spend as much. And it's hard to spend things now. It's hard to try to buy a refrigerator. I've tried. It's not easy. You can't do it. Yeah.
All right, I think we have time for one more question.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr. Fauci got up tomorrow and said the pandemic is over, go back to work, would it have an impact?
You know, I think it's people, if I've learned anything, is that people's personal sense of safety and their willingness, you know, you can open up restaurants, but if they don't feel comfortable going to restaurants, they're not going to go into a restaurant. So I'm not sure that how much of an impact that would have. I think people who haven't been worried about it have been doing whatever they do typically. So I'm not sure how much of an impact that would have. When it does end and everybody feels comfortable, it will be positive. Look, my personal belief is that our economy is on a much stronger basis right now than most people think. You know, we've got some things that are negative, but there's a lot of good things. Other than, I mean, supply chain issues are important, but we're on a much stronger basis than a lot of people think. All right. Sorry it took so long, Joe.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Brian. That brings us to Chairman Items 2B, which can be found in on page 115 of the board packet. So I'd like to introduce Laura O'Kane, and the OWO's staff.
Hi, everyone. I'm Laura O'Kane. I'm the Office of Labor Administrator for the Office of Workforce Opportunity. I kind of gave a higher level update on the first page, page 115, rather than three parts that follow that go over each program year's grants as of June 30th to the end of the program year. The program year has to go through June 30th. I'll give you a minute to take a peek and then let me know if you have any questions. Thank you.
Hanson from OWO staff.
Hi, I'm Jim Hanson with the Office of Workforce Opportunities. I'm the Rapid Response Coordinator. One of the good things is we transitioned into this new year. The official reporting year is July 1st to June 30th, and we've only documented 4 rapid responses so far this year, which is a significant drop from last year. At this time, we had 9. And so far, we're only looking at 218 workers being impacted. The industries that were hit were healthcare, manufacturing, and education, kind of spread across New Hampshire. Really wasn't focused in on one area. The good news about that is with the hiring needs, we had a tremendous number of people and businesses reaching out to us, looking to do everything they could to get existing employees to continue to work. So that was a very positive thing. So I think it's a good trend right now that we're seeing fewer rapid responses going into this year. Moving forward, we are offering in-person rapid responses, but also taking into consideration how people feel and the comfort level of the businesses. We offer a video for small numbers of layoffs or people who can't get to a rapid response, but we also offer a Zoom teleconferencing rapid responses as well. You know, based on what we said last time, we are going to continue to reach out to any layoff notice, whether it's 1 or over the required 25 in which we have to act, just because there's just too many needs for people to, there's too many people looking for work. The one big difference we were able to do, we did provide staff training to business and economic affairs facilitators. We covered the new standard operating procedure. We made sure that they had all the documentation that they needed and kind of gave them a refresher on how to do a rapid response in person and on Zoom. So at this point, we're doing very well. Any questions on what we have going on this year? If not, I'll just keep moving forward. The end of the year report also came up. Since then, on July 30th, I did up an end of the year report. Overall, we had 25 rapid response activities all of the last reporting year that impacted 1,168 employees. Due to the COVID restrictions, it wasn't until June 1st of this year that we actually started offering in-person again. But the in-person rapid responses have been going very well, and we continue to offer Zoom conferencing. The one big difference I would say moving forward, in addition to the training that we provided to the facilitators, we will be doing rapid response team practices online via Zoom at the end of October and the beginning of November. Most of the rapid responses that come in during the year usually hit us in November, December, January, and February. So we're trying to gear up and make sure that we have teams ready to go and being able to get as many options as we can. And that concludes my report.
Thanks very much. Lisa Gerard.
Hi, I'm Lisa Gerard, I'm the OEO Program Administrator for Office of Workforce Opportunity. The program performance update starts on the 2022 in the packet and continues to about 147. I did a CY 2044 update. So our programs, our youth programs, met and exceeded all of their performance measures. Our adult dislocated worker and our national dislocated worker grants met or exceeded all but 1 in each program area for quarter 4. When you look at the program year as a whole, All of our programs are adults, dislocated worker, and youth programs met or exceeded all of their performance measures. That's the year of COVID. So I would highly, So they actually did a really great job with all the barriers that they had, and they all met or exceeded those measures. For adults, we had 256 participants, 160 of those participants received training services. In our disability program, we had 108 participants for the program here, and 78 of them received training services. In youth, we had 271 participants, with 104 of them receiving training services. So, again, they've really pulled out to White Summit with some really great numbers and some really good performance. There's some charts that are out for the year-end reports that kind of break down the program in demographics. And then I included each program provided a year-end summary or a year-end report to the office, and I included those as well for your review. Does anyone have any questions about performance measures? So the next item agenda is actually the 2D, which is the annual monitoring. The annual monitoring summary report. Board member Kelly Clark came over the monitoring reminders. There were quite a few more monitoring activities this year because the OG came over to the office. So we had quite a lot more for Kelly to review. But in general, all the reviews were in compliance. There were no findings, and any findings or issues were taken care of. We also gave Kelly the PY21 monitoring schedule, and both Kelly and Jim King signed off on the monitoring report and the monitoring schedule. But I'd be happy to answer any questions if anyone has, or if Kelly would like to add anything.
I had a question at the office out of school you. You noted that couldn't fill the program because there were many of the young kids who were getting the extra benefits than if they were made ineligible for the program. Has that now receded, and are you getting more applicants, or do you expect to?
So enrollments currently are trending where they should be. Enrollments on all the programs last year wasn't just the youth programs, it was across the board, adults, associated worker. They were all down enrollment-wise. I'm imagining the issue with COVID and benefits and the not having to do job search and things like that. But enrollments currently are all trending where they should be. So I'll move on to the agenda item 2F, which is program success stories. We try to include program success stories from all of the different programs, both adults, associated worker, as well as all the different new sites. I'm not sure that I can answer any questions about them in general, but if you do, I'd be more than happy to help.
At the time of the report, we had multiple responses.
The SNAP Employment and Training State Plan was reviewed in the review subcommittee supports the work of the Bureau of Employment Support as part of their efforts to have coordination with the State Workforce Information Board. The review committee did that. And further, the review committee recommends inviting staff from the Bureau of Employment Support, which has been running this year, down the line to discuss their efforts. But I didn't know if Dave or Kelly wanted to chime in on anything that I might have neglected or overlooked.
That's great. That was great.
Any questions? Karen?
What's the JCON? What is the Outdoor Recreation RFP?
So the State Workforce Innovation Board released a RFP for qualified contractors to look at outdoor recreation as talent attraction and retention. So we released that, and we released it but with a new program that we're going to talk about, the VIP program, and the potential to also receive other non-VOA federal funds that are coming our way at the workforce office. We're going to hold off on issuing that RFP due to staff time and efforts, and re-release that same RFP in January, February is the hope and goal. So the RFP is on the New Hampshire Works website, and was released, I'm trying to remember, it was a topic of conversation in June 8th meeting, sometime in the past summer, fall, early fall. I can't remember the date.
So it's a workforce development plan that you're looking for.
So we're looking at leveraging outdoor recreation resources here in the state to be a talent attraction and retention mechanism, so we're not losing
private workforce.
Yeah, so it would be kind of like a rising tide of all ships sort of deal. And then we're looking forward to re-releasing that, but with the VIP and a few other efforts, we're a small team.
Jay, if you look at the last meeting we had, there was a presentation made by a couple of people who knew a lot about the industry to show what the needs were and what they would be able to do with money. And if you get a chance to look through it, it's quite interesting.
Thank you.
So, as Julie was saying,
the
record, so did it, the RFP was released, were there submission, did it be re-released?
So we're going to let we're working on language now, we're exercising Section 7, period F, remember to search correct, that we're going to re-release the funding, update some priorities, because we're also potentially seeing if some federal funds come in that could be utilized instead of VOA dollars, so that's why we're kind of put into a little bit of a spot. So we would re-release, but we did have multiple responses, both past technical review, and both were competitive prospects. So we hope to see those two folks respond again and perhaps even more. So we did have an accelerated timeline because we saw some projects come, but it's just there's a lot of federal dollars out there currently.
I'm going to make sure I understand. Thank you.
We need to move on. Back to you, Lisa.
Lisa Gerard, Lincoln Record. So on page 166, it is the closeout for the National Health Emergency Grant, which is our supposed to be a record demonstration grant, the CEO grant. It ran from July 1st, 2018 and ended June 30th, 2021. We had a total of 315 participants. They reached 79% of their goal. They had a goal of 400. There were a total of 26 trainings funded directly through the grant, and we did some individual training and on-the-job training with that. There was money left at the end of the grant, so that was returned because the grant ended. Is there any questions about that?
What contributed to the lower than goal for enrollment? Because I'm assuming that's why so much of the money wasn't spent.
It was directly related to COVID. When COVID hit, the recovery centers closed their doors to them. So if they really struggled with enrollment during COVID, it's also a very hot population. So that also kind of came into it. They found, Southern New Hampshire Services found that the biggest stumbling block, I guess you could say, was with documentation. So with individuals actually being able to get their documentation as soon as possible, so copies of birth certificates, social security cards, things like that. People in recovery or people trying to be in recovery, there's a lot going on, and that was just seems to be the stumbling block. Any other questions?
Don't go away. You guys see the
Against the record, Joe Dorian. New Hampshire Works website and the New Hampshire Department of Administrative Services has a current RFP up from our office for real funds with the Vibrant, Inclusive, and Prosperous program, utilizing adult real funds, $1.2 million over a 30-month period of performance, and we're targeting January 1st, 2022, and ending through June 30, 2024. As I mentioned, we have the RFP released, but the goal of the RFP is to engage with historically marginalized populations, for those who have been systemically excluded, and we have some lists in there, including communities of color, New Americans, immigrants, refugees, caregivers, children, disabled, older adults, women, the LGBTQ+ community, homeless individuals, single parents, and veterans. And the idea of recovery and engagement to try to get them into our adult services. Again, that there's eligibility requirements, but pacing plan for that. Lisa, did I miss anything? I think I did.
No, I think you got everything. So we're looking, the RFP is for to partner with some agencies that can do referrals and outreach so that they can then kind of bring that pipeline into the adult program. So it's really working with or trying to get agencies within those marginalized communities kind of doing the outreach and the groundwork to get participants, but also to help with the documentation and try to get that all set up before we get them into the case managers and community applicators.
And we understand the need for, of course, more folks to move into the state. I think it's also equally important that we fully engage with all of New Hampshire citizens as well. So this is, we're trying to attack the workforce problem from all kinds of different ways to engage different populations and whatnot. So we're trying to take feedback that we've heard from out the field and implement it as fast as we can.
Again, this is Rob for the record. So the combined state plan was almost just issued, it seems like, but we already have the same vision based on WEAL statute. So with that in mind, we have created or come up with a plan where we would hold public comment sessions. The list is on the page 168. We'll be holding those in conjunction with the New Hampshire Works partners and basically opening up for public comments so that we can take those comments and then do the revisions that need to happen on the combined state plan. Those revisions are due to USDOL by April 1st of 2022. So we're trying to get a head start and get things in the pipeline early so that we can have as much time as we need to actually do revisions in the writing.
Is there any questions for you? Item 3A is approval of the calendar.
bylaws require 3 meetings a year and a schedule for meetings to be developed annually. So we put together some draft time for those with a request to action and draft motion. And of course, the location can be determined once the happens again. Here, there's some very generous stuff off of Facebook here today. So everybody behave while you're still here. We have a draft motion at the bottom, Mr. Chairman, for consideration for it. So, I think if there's a motion on the floor.
Oh, right.
Does anyone want to make a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And just for the record, there's a sense of time who made the motion and seconded by the same thing. Item 3B, Mr. Chairman, is a continuation of the conversation that we started in February. At the community meeting, I should back up, the bylaws committee met, subcommittee met on May 10th at 2 o'clock p.m. Bylaws committee was Julie Demers, Jonathan Melanson, and who's the third person I'm trying to find?
Kelly.
Oh, Kelly. Thank you. The drafting of the bylaws. We then sent it to USDOL and the New Hampshire Department of Justice to ensure compliance and ensure that we weren't doing anything wrong. They go through their sign-off. The proposed bylaws were presented at the June 8th State Workforce Innovation Board meeting, but could not be voted upon at that meeting per the existing bylaws. Staff has not received any suggestions or feedback following the bylaws being proposed for this meeting on June 8th. The first few pages of the packet, you'll see it's labeled State Workforce Opportunity Bylaws, let's say page 1 through 4. Those are the current existing bylaws. And then on page 176, shows the proposed bylaws as June 8th. Chairman, we're happy to entertain a motion or discussion or whoever is to get to speak.
Would anyone like to make a motion?
No.
Second.
Thank you. Who made the motion? I'm sorry.
You are the second.
And seconded by what?
All in favor?
Aye.
Laura, back to you, Laura King.
Hannah Moore, I've been to the record. So on page 181 is the start of a description of CY21 formula funding for the OSIO 1, which again is about using duplicated workers. This is for the budget breakdown that you can see a chart at the right after page 186. It's the target stuff, but 181.86 describes the breakdown, some of the reasoning. So the aggregate funding that we were awarded for this program here for those three parts of the Title I is $8,049,758. That, of course, is broken amongst and we're informed how what the breakout is, what youth adults located on the car. Again, we have to, we're required to hold at least 10% aside for discretionary funding, 5% for our admin. And with the exception of dislocated worker, at least 85% has to go out to the program. Dislocated worker we do hold, in this case, this year, 10% for rapid response. So I'm going to let you take a look at that for a moment and let me know if you have any questions about it.
Thank you.
Jay Conn. Does this represent any change in funding over the last year? Overall, the $8
million. Sorry, just for clarification, Senator, when you say change in funding, do you mean just compared to prior?
It seems higher.
Yes, you are correct. So normally, New Hampshire is a minimum funded state where we get the minimum that goes out to other states. However, because of the unemployment rate and the impacts of COVID, we did receive more. If you look back at last program year, I believe we received $6.1 million in the aggregate. So this is quite an increase. But again, it's a formula funded program. So assuming our unemployment rate has gone down, I wouldn't expect to see this again next program year.
It's good news. I don't know the obligations that come with additional $2 million of funding, more programs, bigger programs, but it sounds like a one-time opportunity to invest maybe in outdoor recreation opportunities. I don't know. Your guidance on that, I think, would be a valuable.
I think we're certainly being very conservative with the funding. We're trying to not overextending ourselves. I mean, if you look at the budget, you'll see like some excess funds here and there, but we don't want to overcommit ourselves with, for instance, like EOU, for example, we're being very careful because we don't want to build programs and create new sites just to close them 2 or 3 years down the line. So I think we're taking a very careful and conservative approach, and hopefully we can come to the board sooner rather than later with additional funding initiatives with that carry forward that we have, but we want to be very careful. It's a very fluid situation.
And I think that the VIP program is a good example of a way in which we can enhance the program while maintaining something that's sustainable.
Incentives
that they would attain, and I listed out for you. And we basically capped it at $25 per attainment or incentive. We would cap as well what they can earn each year. So, yeah, do you take any questions?
More of an observation comment, it might be like a year out, an opportunity to come back and share with us the results, given that we've not done this before.
Yeah. Absolutely. We are always looking at ways to collect data on anything that is new or something that we create so that we can have whether or not it's working, basically. So we would, if this is approved by the board, we would put it in motion. It wouldn't be a full year this year. So we might come back and give you some information after we institute it, if it's approved. But then we would really want to look at full program year to a full program year.
And for the record, the question was asked by Kelly Clark.
Any questions for Lisa? Go back to you.
Myself, actually, I talked about motion, day job.
All clear?
Aye. Aye.
Industry. There are other industries that will be impacted by not not being able to leverage the workers that they want to be from the country. So I don't know if there's a role of force play in trying to advocate for some of those issues to be straightened out. Especially in this day, as we all are trading
Jim Prue, to your point, maybe a presentation, education, rather than just trying to educate the board would be a good step at the next meeting, to have that presentation on the process and how different companies or industries, to your point, could take advantage, or at least understand the groundwork and how you even start. And then we could maybe go from there and spread that educational component of how it's done, because everybody's struggling with the same thing.
Thank you. I think that's a great opportunity to try to build these around a few meetings. One that I wonder about is our construction trades, the workforce there. Should there be an infrastructure investment? Let's hope that there is. I think we are understaffed in the state to absorb a great influx of infrastructure dollars, and I'd be interested in how some people who are closer to that see the ladder of opportunity growing to meet the demand. In the other place that I think is interesting to see if there's a state role is the diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that companies like Fidelity and others have announced that seem like they're very internal in their focus. Is there something that they might see as an overarching unifying theme across the state that might be valuable for their efforts?
I think it'd be great to get a report from community colleges with regards to how things are going with enrollments. Where do they see strong enrollments? Where would they like to see stronger enrollments? That sort of thing. Find out what's going on at that level with training.
David, maybe we could include in that how they feel we can be leveraging technology to get more people access to community colleges.
Sorry. Tim Sink, I don't know if this is appropriate, but a better understanding of how supply chain issues are affecting employment, what the overlaps might be. It seems like it's a problem that we're going to be having for not just the next 6 months or a year, but this is a multi-year problem.
Joe? Yes. I was wondering if Beth Doran from the Community College System, if you wanted to just respond to your question just real briefly. As far as, I mean, you can certainly do a report at the next meeting, but enrollments are, you know, a little bit below what they were pre-pandemic still, but that's obviously nationally, same things happen nationally. Our biggest programs, I think, we're seeing in things like advanced manufacturing and allied health, those programs are still very strong. But, again, not where they were pre-pandemic, so certainly not potentially able to fill the need as it is now. But happy to provide some. We're focusing a great deal on our non-credit side of the house. We have a new chancellor, I believe, as you all may know, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, who comes from Grand State College and is heavily into workforce development there. So that is a priority for him. So how can we potentially market our shorter-term non-credit programming as well as we do our credit-bearing courses? So that will be a big push for us to try to meet the workforce demands as well.
Do the community colleges teach nursing?
Yeah, every community college has a nursing associate's degree.
Senator, is there
is a 4-year requirement to become a nurse right now, if I understand
you
correct.
So,
two. No. Well, level.
There's a whole ladder of nursing credentials, beginning with the LPN, like a practical nurse.
There's a nursing crisis in the country right now.
Yep.
Hospitals cannot hire nurses.
Yep.
And some of the, I guess, maybe the more specialized nursing takes 4 years to get a degree, and maybe that we should at least have a look at if we could truncate that and put that on a state level.
The legislature actually helped us out with the development of Thorns and the College students are helped us out with the development of our LPN program. We, up until 2 years ago, the year before the pandemic, we did not have an LPN program. We did years ago, and then the need sort of fizzled. So we ended those sunset of those programs. But recently, within the last few years, we've heard from especially the long-term care facilities of a huge need for LPN. So we did start an LPN program in River Valley Community College first. Mm-hmm. It's since moved to Lakes Region. They start in January for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Lakes Region started last week. Both programs only have 10, allow for 10 people, but they're full. And I believe River Valley is starting a second cohort of 10 in January, and White Mountains will also be starting in January. So that's a 1-year program, mm-hmm. and then our 2-year RN programs are the RN associate degree programs, and then there's the 4-year bachelor BSN program as well, which is not necessarily a couple bonus, but it's more management mm-hmm. For nursing. But we also have a number of apprenticeship programs that we're working on, and LNA specifically, as well as medical assistants and M&As, a number of different allied health programs, and we're hoping down the line to do some sort of LNA to LPN to RN apprenticeship where it'll just be a smooth transition through all of those three careers through an apprenticeship program so they're working while they're learning.
I mean, I think it's a good idea to have that part of the community college report. And this is a way that we can expedite getting nurses into the system. Because I sat down with the CEO of Portland Hospital, and he was telling me that they're paying visiting nurses now $200 an hour, and they can't get them. $200 an hour.
So, Beth Thorne again, we typically, pre-pandemic, but pre-pandemic, many of our nursing programs, especially in the city colleges like Manchester, Nashua, Concord, would have 200 to 300 people apply for, I think we have 40 to 60 seats per college. So those numbers have declined as well. The number of people applying now are far lower than what we've had pre-pandemic. So hopefully that will turn and we'll see more people coming back in, but it's we can't meet the demand with just what we have, with the number of slots.
Is there a way to expand the number of seats?
That requires an awful lot of additional clinical sites that need to come on board, so that would be an effort, I think, with the legislature. We need to look at something like that.
You know, like one of the things I read here is that the vaccine mandates in a lot of places are causing nurses to resign. And if we get through this pandemic, God bless Dr. Fauci and Denver, a lot of, I think you're going to see these things filling in again. But I see it in the Upper Valley, at the AHMC. We had protests there where you drive in, over a week, telling people to forget to get vaccinated. And then you got protests on the other side saying, we support the nurses. You need to get vaccinated, that sort of thing. But these vaccination mandates are affecting the health field. And on the way up, I listened to the radio station, and they were saying that emergency workers in Maine are resigning as a result of vaccine mandates. So there you go.
Yeah.
We have no control for that. Maybe.
I think
Beth, Jennifer, what kind of financial benefits are available for the programs that you have? Are there tuition benefits for students that want to get into these programs?
Well, we have Pell Grants, which are for certain income levels, and then we also have the Community College Foundation, which can assist with scholarships as well. So
for a two-year student, what would it cost them to complete this program?
It's about $6,000 a year.
Per year.
I mean, the nursing might be a little bit more expensive, but pretty much it's, an average of $6,000 a year.
Right.
But then there's the LEOLA funding and Work Now and all of that can come into play as well to assist with scholarship money and not scholarship, but funding for training.
Right. You know, David, you were talking about the shortage of healthcare workers. That shortage was there long before COVID. COVID has exacerbated it, but it was there long before because of the grain of our state in America. It was projected we were, you go back 15 months, 2 years ago, we were about 1.5 million short of healthcare workers then. That's prior to COVID. So it's made it much, much worse. As far as funding, we do some private for them ourselves. If we can locate a person with a proper work ethic, we can scholarship at ILMA, working hand in hand with Beth and Great Bay and Manchester Community College. And a really, really good partnership for us. Matter of fact, and you talk about buying cars, that was music to my ears because we've had to buy a half dozen cars ourselves for people who wanted to work, but they just needed a car. So we've been doing some extraordinary things in healthcare. So it goes all the way down to LNAs and companion caregivers. We need help. I was happy to hear about the TANF program, with the adjustments you guys are thinking that are being made. That will help us a lot. We have people who can only work 15 or 20 hours a week because they're afraid they might lose their benefits. It's understandable.
Thank you, Chairman. No, I think Mr. Cruz, J-Con, sorry. Mr. Cruz's question about what does it cost to attend a community college? And it may cost nothing. And not because they've discounted the rate to zero. It's because federal financial aid, governor scholarship funds, other scholarship funds that exist that either the state or the community college system through philanthropy has raised, it's very possible that a needy student doesn't need to pay a tuition rate, which I believe is closer to the $7,500 number, $215 credit hour. But that's what I guess I'd like you to think about, that if people want to attend and start on a career track, there are opportunities for them to do that in the state without incurring debt.
Well, Beth, as soon as you start telling them they're going to get $200 an hour,
No, and I guess my point was, what is industry doing to dovetail? Like, if it's hospitality or it's healthcare or it's energy, right? What are we doing as an industry to support the place that's going to produce the workers right now? And you need more labs, and you need more instructors, and you need more seats, and you need more infrastructure. It seems to me that that's going to be an ongoing thing, and how can we partner with we, meaning in general, with the source of those valuable, extremely valuable $1,200 an hour valuable.
Yeah, because those programs are very expensive to run. They're the most expensive programs to run.
All right.
Mike
Summers,
Mike Summers. And all of this is awesome and great, but if you don't have enough workers in the system, we're just passing people around. At the end of the day, you're still, 15, 20, 30,000 workers short in the system. So I would love for us to have a conversation. I don't know how we get there. How do we attract more workers? Because I can tell you that the number of students coming out of the high schools is less and less every single year. So you're not going to do it just through kids coming out of high school. So how are we as a state going to put a serious effort behind bringing new talent to the state of Canada?
I think
John, I just got to echo that. We had some breakout groups a couple years ago, and a lot of us first joined the board, and several people in that group had that same sentiment, Mike. So, you know, attracting a larger pool to this workforce in New Hampshire, we've got a lot to offer here, would be a great discussion.
All right. Before we go much further, Jonathan Levin has a super important announcement to make.
So, I just wanted to, on behalf of our office, I know Mayor Love is retiring. I think at the end of this year, that will complete your time working with the State Workforce Innovation Board, at least a board member. And I just wanted to thank you for all of your work, time that you've put in, and it's some very big shoes to try to fill.
All right, so there's nothing else. Joe, it's been taking me to read the last paragraph here. Again, for the record, this is Mike Shane, Chairman of the Board. I would like to thank the members of the Board for their participation and attendance today, our presenters and staff, for putting this meeting together. This concludes the duly noted meeting. And it was conducted in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. Thank you to the members and public for joining the duly noted meeting of the State Workforce Innovation Board. Please have the recording. Oh, we need a motion for adjournment. I don't like it.
So moved.
Second. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Jimmy, you have to nominate the members. I love it. Good.